folk music. Rate my music, 1, 2, 3. Keep your children safe from me. Rate my writing, X, Y, Z. That's what keeps this country free. You got Ma Rainey talking about a jelly roll. Chuck Berry working on a mojo. Bessie Smith singing Bull Dagger Blues. Elvis twitching on the evening news. Rate my music, 1, 2, 3. Keep your children safe from me. Rate my writing, X, Y, Z. Living in the land of liberty, yeah. You better rate Walt Whitman, Jean Cocteau. All the fags will have to go. Alexander the Great and Plato and such. Your kids might catch it if they read too much, yeah. Well, I watched the news last night at 9. I saw a head blown off somebody's spine. While the women moaned and the children screamed. Doesn't anybody else think that's obscene? Rate my music, 1, 2, 3. Keep your children safe from me. Rate my writing, X, Y, Z. That's what keeps this country free, yeah. Gonna raid all the dagos, the wops and the kikes. Gonna raid all the chinks and the towelhead types. Gonna raid all the niggas, gonna raid all the fags. Gonna wrap it up tight in the American flag, yeah. All you folks who bitch and moan about the music your kids buy and bring on home, tell me just one thing before we're done. Where'd they get their money from? Rate my music, 1, 2, 3. Keep your children safe from me, yeah. Rate my writing, X, Y, Z. Cause that's what keeps this country free. Rate my music, be my guest. I don't care, it's just more press. Rate my writing if you dare. Cause when you're gone, I'll still be there. When you're gone, I'll still be there. When you're done, I'll still be here, yeah.
Welcome to Queer Voices on KPFT, and this segment is called Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and I'm here on the fourth Monday of each month to bring you an hour devoted to our culture's music. I started the show with a little of the song Rate My Music by Janice Ian. It's a song about music censorship. Janice Ian provided one of my 3 special interviews for tonight's show. Also on tap is a songwriter I think you should know about named John Calvey, and a new artist from Florida, Stephen Franz, whose debut album is one of my favorites of last year. Let's start with Janice Ian. She shouldn't need much introduction, as she's been in our consciousness since her first big hit in 1967, Society's Child. And of course her classic At 17 was a masterpiece, winning a Grammy Award in 1975. Last year she released her first official live album, a double CD set called Working Without a Net, and this year she brings us her 18th studio album, Billy's Bones. Janice was in Houston on March 7th to perform at a wonderful folk venue called McGonagall's Mucky Duck, and I met up with her that afternoon before the show. Now, unfortunately, the club was having repair work done on the roof, so my recording conditions were less than ideal, so please bear with me a little on that. I started out asking her about the new album, Billy's Bones.
Billy's Bones is a real labor of love in that it's the first album I went into, well, not counting the live album, working with Annette. It's the first studio album I've gone into knowing that I would own it 100% and that I was only going to lease it. So I think it took on a different characteristic. We had lots of time to plan. We had plenty of time to think about the various musicians we were going to use, lots of time to put the team together. And I think the album reflects that there was a lot of thought put into it.
Tell me about the title track.
To me, there are two great singers in the generation before mine, and that's Billie Holiday and George Jones. And Billie is just, she's about the best phraser I know of. She's where I go before every album to listen to for a month to make sure that my phrasing's on track. She's what I aspire to.
Billie's tears fall like dust from the air into my eyes, seeping in the ether, they rust, spilling secrets words can't hide. I am standing on the bones of a man too high to climb, selling secrets for a song that is not mine. Billy's bones are white and bleached, piled high and hard to reach, and the top looks cold and bleak, but I see farther when I stand on Billy's bones.
Can you please tell me about the song Matthew?
Well, I think when the Matthew Shepard incident happened, obviously we were all shocked. I mean, not just within the gay community, but the community at large was shocked at the ferocity and the sheer senselessness. You know, it's as senseless to us as a Waco or a 9/11. In fact, those make a little more sense, you know, because at least they're politically motivated. But a Matthew Shepard incident is just the result of two very badly raised young men who then allowed their upbringing to spill over into violence. You know, somebody had to teach them to hate like that and to have that kind of contempt. And I was bothered because a lot of the songs being written about it glorified him and almost indicated that he would be happy to know the good he'd done. And I just kept thinking about his mother and thinking, I'm sure that all the good he's done isn't worth an extra day with him to her, you know? And the more I thought about it, the angrier I got. And the angrier I got, the more I wanted to write about it. And Matthew is the result.
Footsteps on gravel at the neighborhood bar. Things start to unravel, then they go too far. The sound of pain written on the wind fades to gray and then goes dim. Boy is tied to a barbed wire fence for the crows to ride, for the claws to clinch, for the sweet bouquet of blood and bone to undermine the scent of collegiate cologne. What makes a man a man? The cut of a coat, the hint of a tan. It's not who you love, but whether you can. What makes a man a man? Mm-hmm.
So who did he harm? What was the crime? Did he walk too lightly? Did he seem too shy? Did he make them wonder deep inside? Did they feel like real men when he died? Did the waning moon look down from on high? Did the twinkling stars try to catch his eye? Did the wind caress his flesh and bone? Did they leave him there to die alone? What makes a man a man? The cut of a coat, the hint of a tan. It's not who you love, but whether you can. What makes a man a man? Now the stars are nailed to an empty sky, and the moon is pinned like a big butterfly. And I'm afraid to shine too bright, since the day so mothers teach your children this. Don't overreach, don't run the risk. Hide in the shadows, don't expect your good heart to save your neck. What makes a man a man? The cut of a coat, the hint of a tan. It's not who you love, but whether you can. That makes a man a man. That makes a man a man.
I've read that the What Makes a Man a Man theme is something that you've been considering for a song for years.
The idea of What Makes a Man actually comes from a Marcel Marceau piece that I saw back when I was a kid on The Tonight Show. I think it was called To Be a Man or What Is a Man? But Marceau did a brilliant flip between male-female, male-female. And so that idea has fascinated me ever since, the idea of what is it that men regard as the manliness, you know.
What would you say is your most lyrically gay song, your most out song?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it runs through from Take No Prisoners, where I refer to my lover as she, to Ride Me Like a Wave, which doesn't refer to a gender but is overtly sexual with female images. To You Don't Know My Heart, which is, I guess, overtly gay. I don't actually think about it too much. You know, as a writer, I don't think about it.
It's not a goal.
No, it's not. I mean, I know for some writers it is, but for me, the goal has always been to hit as much of the universal as I possibly can in each song.
How about the song Maria?
Well, yeah, I guess for 1975, that was pretty overt.
Did people pick up on it?
I think gay people did. I think straight people weren't looking for it and didn't see it. They would now.
From the album Miracle Row, released in 1977, here's Maria.
Oh, Maria, your eyes are like a demon, la
lover's child, and lips of velvet issue invitation every time you smile. You sucked me in, I must admit that I was waiting for a sign. Won't you leave me on the corner by the light, because I'm stepping out tonight. Oh, Maria, I envy any man who knows your name. For once I knew you well, I'm not ashamed to be the one who drags you down. Your life is like a movie, like a story pasted up on subway walls. Won't you leave me something sacred when you fall, unless there's nothing left at all. Teeth and schoolboy husbands beg relief, and empty lovers search the street.
When did you come out publicly?
I got outed in 76 in the Village Voice. But I really came out with a vengeance, I guess, in 92, because Irvishy Vade impressed upon me that it was really important to for gay kids to have a role model, and I had never had a gay role model, but for that book, The Well of Loneliness, and, you know, when I got done reading that, I thought, if that's being gay, then I'm not going to be gay.
So you were outed. How did you deal with that?
I think I went to bed for a day. Stayed in bed, and then my lover said, come on, get up, time to get up, and I just dealt with it. You know, it was, I mean, to me, my family had always known, my friends had always known, the record company had always known, so for me, it wasn't that big a shock, because I had all of their support.
In one article, I read that you were planning on coming out prior to being outed. Is that true?
No. No, I really didn't want, and remember that the atmosphere in the 70s was very different from the 90s, and I really didn't want to be pigeonholed into the, nothing wrong with them, but into the Olivia Records group, which was really the only visible group of gay female musicians. It's hard enough being a female musician, you know, without everybody looking at my songs and thinking, oh, she's writing about gay people. So, whereas in the 90s, I figured it was an open secret anyway, and in the 90s, people had relaxed a little bit about the gender roles and about the roles between gay and straight.
And they wouldn't automatically cast gender on a song.
Right. And also by the 90s, I had enough of a back catalog that there was no doubt that I was a good writer. And it's very hard to take somebody who's a good all-around something and pigeonhole them like that.
I read the interview that Melissa Etheridge did with you for The Advocate.
It was a good interview.
Very good. And she commented that to her, the lines, I learned the truth at 17, was, I learned I was homosexual at 17.
Mm.
Do you get that a lot from that song?
No. No. Because I think because the song is so concentrated on just what makes someone different, you know. So whatever it is that made you different, be it a club foot or open heart surgery when you're a kid and being in and out of the hospital or being ugly or what, or being gay. You know, whatever factor is what I hear. Mm-hmm. And since my gay audience isn't my primary audience or the bulk of my audience, I don't hear that much.
When I learned that I would be able to do this interview with you, I emailed a friend of mine named David, who lives in England, and he immediately wrote back that he bought that album when he was 15 because he could identify with the thoughts of being a misfit.
Well, what a cool thing. Isn't that great? I mean, that's the cool thing about a song like 17, that it just really does hit that universal, and it really applies across the board to so many different people.
To those of us who knew the pain of Valentines that never came, and those whose names were never called when choosing sides for basketball, it was long ago and far away. The world was younger than things were all they gave for free to ugly duckling girls like me. We all play the game when we dare to cheat ourselves at solitaire, inventing lovers on the phone, repenting of the lives unknown. Ugly girls like me at 17.
Hi, this is Janice Ian, and you are listening to Queer Music Heritage on KPFT in Houston.
Before we leave Janice Ian, I want to mention a couple things. First, I want to plug her wonderful website at www.janiceian.com. For one thing, it's a very large and in-depth site with lots of information on all her releases. And for those of you who didn't know it, she's written a number of superb columns for The Advocate and Performing Songwriter magazines. Many of those columns are archived on her site. Something very special is a new section called The Making of a CD. It's all about how her latest release, Billy's Bones, progressed from the early stages through to the finished product. And you can hear her discuss decisions on the project. And you can hear many rough demos of the tracks. This is especially interesting as the CD includes a duet with Dolly Parton, and those early studio takes are also present. It's a fascinating look on how a CD is made, and plan on devoting an hour or so to it to really appreciate the magnitude of what Janice is sharing with her fans. And finally, on her site, you can buy a number of special CD releases with songs not available anywhere else. These include tracks like the song Rate My Music, which I used to open the show. And one of the CDs also included this wonderful quote by her that I cannot pass up sharing with you.
It's an amazing thing to be a songwriter. You know, you pray to write songs like 17 or Stars or Jesse that touch people's hearts. You hope to make some kind of a change in people's lives and also earn a living while you're doing it. And I've been really lucky. I think it's just the best job in the world, because, you know, artists, when we're doing our job, we get to take people's dreams and make something visible out of them. And then when people forget that they have dreams and everything looks really dark and horrible, we get to remind you that they exist.
You have probably not heard of my next guest. His name is John Calvey, and he lives in Vermont. I want to bring some attention to him because he wrote what I consider to be one of the most beautiful anthems of our gay musical culture. I'm talking about the song, The Ones Who Aren't Here, which you may know from Mae Christian's Carnegie Hall album. I think it's a terrific song because it deals with an area not often found in music. It's sung from the point of view of people who are out of the closet, singing to those who have not yet made that journey, who feel they cannot come out, for whatever reasons. Now, John these days is a certified massage therapist and a Quaker healer who works with victims of trauma, so he's not really known as a singer at all. Though he did a bit of that early in his career, in the late 70s, I asked him about that. How did you get started with gay music?
Well, I began writing gay songs probably when I was about 18 or so. They were sort of, not very outward. But certainly there were love songs that were being written then. And I think my first out songs were probably when I was about 25 or so.
Did you start performing them around that time, or...?
Yeah, well, I started performing as soon as possible, as soon as anyone would listen to me. But I started playing in gay coffee houses back in, the mid-70s. And, I played at Maxine Feldman's coffee house in Boston and some of the MCC churches that have little coffee houses in New England. So a little bit here and there, not very much.
Tell me about Maxine Feldman's coffee houses. She's one of my idols.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, this is back in the olden days of late 70s, early 80s. And Maxine was I guess, still recording, still performing. And I think there was, I think it was at the Unitarian Church on Arlington Street. And, you know, it was just sort of a little church basement with a couple dozen chairs. And she would have someone come in every week or every other week.
I interviewed her on the phone, and she struck me as being very, very warm.
Absolutely. Yeah, she is very warm. She's very forthright and very strong. And in a fight, you'd always want her on your side. Absolutely. Yeah, she's wonderful.
You mentioned in one of our emails that you had an association with Michael Callan.
Yes. I met Michael in the late 80s when he was very interested in my song. And I had gone backstage to offer him some massage. He was at a point where he was still strong, but the touring was exhausting for him. And I went backstage during a Flirts concert to offer him some massage and energy work. And as I was working on him, John Atherton came up to me and he said, "You're the one who wrote that song." And I said, "Yes." And John turns to Michael and says, "Michael, he wrote The Ones Who Aren't Here." And Michael said, "You do this and massage?" So Michael and I got a chance to do massage maybe three or four different times. And I got a chance to work on him after his very last concert in Washington, D.C., after the big march there. And that was the last time he appeared with the Flirts.
I've often said that for his contributions to gay music and gay activism, he should be sainted.
Well, he was so delighted by irreverence. I think he would much rather have a rest area named after him than to be sainted. Yes, he was a delight. He was a rabble-rouser and a troublemaker, and he was very good at it.
With all the talk of gay marriage in the news lately, I can't help but ask about something I read about you. It involves you and your partner's union having some historical significance other than just your own.
Well, apparently, when Marshall and I were married by our Quaker meeting in 1989, in August, Marshall wrote a beautiful wedding announcement. Kind of a highfalutin kind of a thing, and sent it into the local newspaper here, the Brattleboro Reformer, and they printed it on their wedding page. And apparently it was the first time in the history of American journalism that a gay wedding announcement was put on the wedding page and not on the police blotter or, you know, not under freak occurrences. And that has been recorded by the American Journal Society.
That's terrific. Can you tell us about your current projects?
Well, my current project is I'm at home working on a book. I have been traveling the country for the last 22 years teaching about healing from trauma. And I am writing a book to talk about how it is I see when in my work with inmates, women who have had sexual assault, refugees who've been tortured, people with AIDS, how it is that people get well following trauma. And part of that book will have some of my songs in it because I have really found music to be a very strong healing part. My own healing and also for many people that I work with.
Okay, now I want to talk about the whole reason for this segment. Tell me about the writing of the song, The Ones Who Aren't Here.
Well, I wrote The Ones Who Aren't Here in the spring of 1981. The fall of the year before, I had been thrown out of my family for being gay. And I was about 30 years old and told never to come home again. And I went into a stark depression, and I began to get some massage, and I began to get some psychotherapy, And by the time spring came around, that depression lifted, and it really did lift with the writing of that song. So I wrote that in the spring, and I was thinking about how sad it was that there were men and women sitting at home, afraid to let anyone know or even to tell themselves that they were gay. And how sad that was. And it was really a song to speak to how blessed we were to be able to get together with community, and how we had to keep an eye out for these people who hadn't yet gotten there. And we really didn't need to bring them to the fire, because they were really hurting without us. And the day that I wrote that song, I can remember I wrote it with a stubby pencil, and it was on brown paper, like a paper bag paper, and I couldn't stop singing it. I just kept singing it over and over and over. And I just loved it, and I knew it was a good piece of work.
Some writers say the song just poured through them. Yeah. And others have to work at it like a craft.
Well, it very much poured through me. It felt like a light went on, and it felt almost like I had to learn it from inside of myself. And there was no pulling or pushing. There was no rewriting. It was almost as though I was learning it from the inside.
How did the song get to Meg Christian?
Well, Meg was doing a concert down at Northampton, Massachusetts, which was it's about 40 miles away from Putney, Vermont, where I live. And so I drove down. Meg is one of my absolute favorite singers ever. And I drove down to see this concert, and I put this song on a tape. And I went to walk backstage, and two very large women said, "Where do you think you're going?" But I sent the tape back to her. And maybe a half a year later, I got a postcard from her thanking me for the song, that she thought it was very beautiful, and that she was using it in concerts. And then later that year in the fall, she used it at Carnegie Hall. And I didn't know that she had recorded it. I didn't know she'd performed it at Carnegie Hall. And a friend of mine came and said, "My God, I heard your song at Carnegie Hall. Meg was singing it, and she mentioned your name." And I was shocked.
There are two other beautiful recordings I know about. Do you have any thoughts or reminiscences about those?
Well, I was living in Washington, D.C., when Suede was making her first album. I had moved there from Los Angeles. We had talked when I was out there about her wanting to record ones, and I was happy to have her do it. She has such a beautiful voice. And I thought she just did a wonderful job with it.
Some people use that song as a tribute to people who have passed away.
Yes, it's used at many, many memorials. Yes, it is.
How do you feel about it being used that way? I don't think that was really the thought.
Well, you know, when you make a song, it's sort of like having a child. It really goes off into the world and has a life of its own. And I've had many straight people come to me and say, "You know, this song has such universal meaning that it really cannot be for just one thing alone." And so it's used at weddings for people who can't come to the wedding, and it's used at memorials for the beloved who has passed. And it's lovely to get a postcard or a phone call and find out that it's being used in another way in another place sometime.
Bill McKinley recorded it.
Yes.
Any connection or thoughts about that recording?
Well, I had moved back here to Vermont when Bill called and asking to record it. And he has such a lovely voice. He did a wonderful job with it.
Of the three, I'm calling them main versions, do you have a pet?
Well, it's, you know, singer does your song, it's a little bit like having an in-law, you know. It's like the daughter-in-law comes home. It was such a thrill for me to hear Meg do it at Carnegie Hall. The song was sort of suddenly revealed to the world and deeply appreciated. Every time that album is reviewed, the song is mentioned. So that has a favorite place in my heart. I really love the arrangement that Suede gave to it.
She adores that song.
Yes.
I've talked to her about it.
Yeah, she really, really does a wonderful job with it. So, you know, it's just such a blessing for me that there are these wonderful singers getting the song around.
Okay, we've been talking for a few minutes now about the song The Ones Who Aren't Here. My listeners are probably thinking, when on earth are we going to hear it? Well, right now. But I have three favorite versions of it. It was originally sung by Meg Christian on her 1982 album, Meg and Chris at Carnegie Hall. And Suede did it on her 1988 debut album, Easily Suede. In 2000, Bill McKinley included it on his CD, Everything Possible. I couldn't pick just one. So I played with my editing program and put them together, giving each artist a verse. First you'll hear Suede, then Bill, and then Meg. And I want to dedicate the song to a friend of mine named Patrick. Here's John Calvey's song, The Ones Who Aren't Here.
I'm thinking about the ones who aren't here and won't be coming in late. Home all alone with a family and won't be coming out tonight. Wish I could know all the lovers and friends kept from
That was Suede, Bill McKinley, and Meg Christian. Besides those three excellent versions, the song has been sung by gay choruses around the world, and I felt it important to capture its story. This is a good time to invite you to visit my website at www.queermusicheritage.com, where you can view the playlist and see photos of the artists and recordings, and listen to the show anytime. And also, be sure to listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Saturday night from midnight to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. For the last segment on tonight's Queer Music Heritage, I'm featuring a new artist who lives in Florida. I just love his album because the music on it is very out. It's his first and is called The One You Choose. His name is Stephen Franz. Tell me about how you came to record your album.
The project took approximately a year to complete. I originally started just doing a four-song demo of some old songs that I had in my back pocket that I really wanted to kind of explore as a solo artist. Over the years, I've worked in different bands and kind of worked that angle, but I really felt it was time for me to kind of go out on my own and to, you know, explore my own music and push it to the limits and do what I want to do rather than, you know, what four other people want to do or whatever. And as a gay singer-songwriter, that was really difficult for me sometimes. In some of the other bands I worked with, while they certainly were accepting of me being gay, you know, it was always about creating the pop hit or something that was going to, you know, be acceptable to a wide audience rather than really just making a statement of who I was and what I felt in the music that I was performing. Anyway, at that time, I decided to go ahead and make a four-song demo, and really as I started the process, my goal was just to create something very musical, very reflective of my style, my influences, and as I kind of got into the studio and got my groove going with that, I just was really pleased with the sound that was coming out on the four songs I originally started with. So I had a few other songs, a few older songs or songs I was still just finishing up. And then I had a couple new songs that kind of came out of the process of just being in the studio and being really into that whole environment and just being very open to new ideas and experiences.
The song 7 Years is kind of your coming out story. Can you tell us about it?
I wrote that the day after I had gone back to the bar where I had originally kind of come out on New Year's Eve, and that's one of the lines in the second verse, New Year's Eve, 4 a.m. in West End Bar. There was an old bar, it's no longer there. It was a gay bar in South Beach on Lincoln Road called West End Bar. It's kind of a rough bar, but for some reason I decided to go there on New Year's Eve, you know, 3:30, 4 in the morning, and I was just, my mind was going, and I was like, this is the night. This is the night I'm going to just go explore the gay side of me and just let it all out there. So I was pulled back to the beach and ended up in West End Bar. Sat down to the bar and had a Heineken. It was really late, so there was hardly anybody there, but I just remember this beautiful Christmas tree, you know, just the beauty of the lights just kind of glimmering in the room. Just kind of mesmerized me into it, and so I had the drink, and then actually moved on to another bar in the area called Twist, which is actually a very famous bar on South Beach, and got in there, and the music was pumping, the crowd was, the guys were all shirtless, it was like, oh, I found home, and within a few minutes, especially at that hour, it was very late at this point, and, you know, people were, if they weren't already hooked up, they were about to get hooked up. So made eye contact with a guy across the bar, and next thing you know, I'm walking down the street with him, you know, saying, oh, let's have some coffee, and yeah, right, we're going to have coffee. So I end up in his hotel room, and pretty much the rest is history, I guess, as they say, but it was quite a wild night. And kind of went right into morning, and scary time, but a wonderfully invigorating time at the same time. So that's really what 7 Years is about. A lot of people think it's a love song or something, you know, I guess the opening line, 7 years since you first walked through these doors is really about coming out. It's really, you know, since you first walked through these doors to this bar, into this new world, you know, coming out of your closet, et cetera, all that image, so... So that's 7 years.
It's been 7 years since you first walked through these doors. You spent 7 years finding out just who you are. Oh, well, it's been 7 years since you opened up your mind.
been hard and long. You've been right and wrong for 7 years. We is Eve forever in West End.
That was a little bit of the song 7 Years. By far my favorite track on the album, and actually one of my favorite gay songs of last year, was Double My Wardrobe. What's the story behind that song?
It's really special gift to me from the songwriting fairies, as I call them. Literally, I was sitting in the same seat I'm sitting in here in my living room, and just got on my guitar and started playing a few chords, and while I was waiting for some friends to come by to go out on, I think it was like a Friday night or something, and the first line just came to me, this is my story and I'm sticking to it, and then the chorus just flowed into it as well. I want to double my wardrobe, leave the seat up late at night, sing Madonna with an attitude. Real happy with that. It's received a lot of nice response from different audiences, both gay and straight. It's funny, a lot of my straight friends will come up and say, oh, that song is just stuck in my head. And a good friend of mine actually was with her boyfriend doing dishes one night, and I guess one was washing, the other was drying, and her boyfriend is very straight, and he kind of turned to her and gave her this strange look, and she's like, what? And she's like, he acknowledged to her that he was actually had that song stuck in his head, and he didn't know what to do. Does this mean I'm gay? So I just thought that was kind of cute.
This is my story, and I'm sticking to it, no matter what people say. So listen, Mommy, and listen, Daddy, your little boy, well, he's not straight. And I don't know where this came from. All I know is I'm feeling good about myself. So don't think that you failed me, or believe that I need help. Just because I wanna double my wardrobe, leave the seat up
empty dance and cry of a broken romance and smile at the queens down on the avenue. This is what I wanted. This is what is true. Well, I had a girlfriend back in the 90s. We were so much alike. We liked the same movies, liked the same singers. Turns out we liked the same guys. So what with all these layers? Tell me, is there some kind of map to find a spot? Need I say when it ended? She was not very shy. Late at night, sing Madonna with an attitude. Oh, if I want to dance at the tea dance and cry over broken romance and smile at the queens down on the avenue. This is what I wanted, yeah. This is what is true.
This is especially for JD. He had a request for me to go through what the third verse on the song really was. I decided not to put the third verse that I had originally written on the record because I thought it was a little too raunchy and I didn't want to keep it from being played on the radio or finding some home. So I'm going to try to record this, the third verse.
Got myself a boyfriend, yeah, and it's nice, never running out of socks. Two suits, two pairs of loafers, hell, we've even got two cocks. And I want to double my wardrobe.
So there you have it, the unofficial second ending to Double My Wardrobe, or second, third verse.
Thanks, Stephen, for indulging me with that. I've got one more song, but before I get to it, I want to thank you all for listening, and to thank Janice Ian, John Cowie, and Stephen Franz for the very special interviews. And as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I've featured, please write to me at qmheritage@aol.com, and I wish you would. My website, logically enough, is at www.queermusicheritage.com, and now also at www.queermusicheritage.org. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston, and I'll be back on the fourth Monday of next month with the next installment of Queer Music Heritage. Stephen, can you tell us a little about the song Inside My Head?
The song was written on my first guitar, Inside My Head, and it really just... I wrote it at a time when I had just graduated from college. I was living at home, not really sure what I wanted to do. Still had a girlfriend, I believe, at the time, or had just broken up with her. So the song is really, you know, about just that feeling of being overwhelmed and wanting to find a place, you know, where you're free to be who you are. And I guess at the time I hadn't really come out yet, but I guess I was drawn to the Dorothy in me and the connection to Wizard of Oz, and I had the line, gonna find a place where I can free my mind, and the bluebird sings. So that was kind of a neat, you know, experience. It was my first real song on a guitar, and I was real proud of that.
Here's Stephen Franz with Inside My Head from the album The One You Choose.
All the world inside my head.